We're continuing to share parts of our discussion from earlier this fall with NBC sports reporter Andrea Joyce. I'd submit that she's most well known for her coverage of the U.S. Open tennis tournament and the Olympics. And this summer, she gave up one to cover the other.
I think I've done 30 U.S. Opens, and I think this is the first year I've missed in ages because I was at the Paralympics.
Okay.
And it was an opportunity that I couldn't pass up, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do the Paralympics. I've done 17 Olympics, and Paris was my 17th, but then I got an opportunity to do the Paralympics, and that was spectacular.
Oh, that had to be
spectacular.
Yeah.
It was my second time on site doing the Paralympics. I had done it the Winter Olympics in 2022, but NBC had made a huge commitment for these games, and it was our first Olympics after two pandemic Olympics, and it was truly, truly incredible to see the athletes respond to our presence there. So every single person I talked to was just, the words were exactly the same. This is the first time we have felt seen. Like, we went everywhere. I was what was called an in-country host, which they had never done before. It didn't mean that we were sitting at a desk. It meant that we basically went to every single event. So we'd get up at 7 in the morning. We would go to archery, and then we would leave there, and we'd go to Versailles and go to the equestrian events, and then we would go to fencing. And we went to all of these sports that never get covered, and these athletes never get interviewed, and they're just forgotten. And it happens at the Olympics, but it truly happens at the Paralympics. We've only been able to have the manpower to cover swimming and to cover track and field and not get much further beyond that. But this time they made a huge commitment, and the athletes felt it. And we felt like we were part of history.
What were some of your favorite memories, or a favorite memory, from either the Olympics or Paralympics this year?
So I think that for the Paralympics, I mean, the Olympics unfold the way they unfold, and you have great moments all the time, and, you know, and it's exciting, and the way that Paris really just embraced everything, and just every place we went, people were friendly, it was beautiful, it was wonderful. But when we got there for the Paralympics, the challenge is to keep that momentum going, is to try and keep that excitement going, because people are literally exhausted. You know, the people who live there are like, okay, we've just done this, and we did it successfully, and now 12 days later, we're going to do it again. And they showed up. People showed up. And one of my favorite moments, I think I told this story the other night, one of my favorite moments came in the last days, one of the final days. We were covering the final for blind soccer. And if you've never seen blind soccer.
Think about that.
I'm just like trying to get a mental picture here.
Go on YouTube and look at blind soccer. Is the most unbelievable. It's so much fun to watch. It's spectacular. So we were there for the semifinals, and then we went for the finals. It was sold out, and so we went to this place they called the French Club. And it was basically a place that, like an airport hangar, that's could see 10,000 people. They sold out. It was like $5 to get in. So they have 10,000 people there to watch blind soccer on a big screen TV. And at halftime, and the crowd's going wild. They're singing the national anthem. It's just spectacular. And at halftime, the guy who's sort of emceeing brings out some French Paralympians. And this guy comes out in a wheelchair, and he had won bronze medal in canoe. Well, at the Olympics, nobody pays that much attention to canoe, and they really don't pay attention at the Paralympics. And this guy had not won a gold medal, he won a bronze. So he comes out, and you would have thought that Taylor Swift was on the stage. This crowd went absolutely wild. They are cheering for him. He starts popping wheelies, and he is dancing in his chair. He picks up his daughter, puts his daughter on his lap, and she's got the medal around her neck. And it's just, it's spectacular. And I'm thinking, when in his life could he ever have dreamt or imagined that kind of moment?
It really hit me because I think we're all kind of there. You said when you were growing up and you saw somebody without an arm or an amputee,
sure,
you just kind of feel sorry for them, right?
Human,
and how that changed
human,
when you...
Human, I think human nature, to, you know, for all of us, you look at someone who's blind, you look at someone in a wheelchair, and you just feel sorry for them. And I was changed. I think 4 days into the Paralympics, I said, okay, they're athletes. And they have the same kind of determination, same commitment. What was amazing to me is that, you know, when we had some sensitivity training before we went and did the Paralympics, because there are nuances of calling, you know, some of these sports. And one of the things that the woman I was working with has a prosthetic leg, and one of the things she said was how important it was to be called an athlete with a disability as opposed to being called a disabled athlete, which at the time I thought, really, is that like that? But it is a big deal because it's not the disability that makes that person who they are. She's an athlete first. And, you know, it was almost like when they used to call Serena, you know, the greatest female tennis player. Well, she's a great tennis player who happens to be a woman, you know. So yep. there's a nuance there, but at the same time, the competitive nature of these athletes is exactly the same of any athlete in any sport I've ever covered. They can be mean. They have rivalries, and it's not all yay, oh, you know, yummy, gummy. I mean, it's intense and spectacular on so many levels that I know that after a couple of days, I walked away and said, okay, I stopped looking at the fact that somebody was in a wheelchair or without eyesight.
These are excerpts from a discussion with NBC sports reporter Andrea Joyce, who joined me and George Wares during the second half of our Central football broadcast against Simpson earlier this fall.
Well, I will tell you, Andrea, that I don't know if you heard our halftime guest, but we had the head of the AFCA, the American Football Coach Association. Ex-coach from, give me the...
North Dakota State,
went to Wyoming.
Yeah.
And he is now really into what's going to happen with NIL and just really, really informative. Thinks it should go to Congress, in his opinion, because somebody's got to do something. So being a Michigan fan, what are you seeing with the big-time money of programs like that?
You know, I have to say that I'm old. I've been around for a really, really long time. And I think that many of us saw the writing on the wall 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And I think that, honestly, like something had to give. And instead of it being a compromise, it ended up being just blown up the way that it has. I emceed a thing for the University of Michigan for the athletic department in New York called the National Coaches Tour in June, where they had Sharon Moore, and then they had the basketball coaches and the lacrosse coaches, and I did a panel discussion with them, and they were doing it for the big donors, and basically, you know, they were saying, listen, everybody's got to get on board here, because for instance, the women's basketball team, she lost 3/4 of her team through the portal because of the NIL money, and it's not that they didn't love her, not that they didn't love Michigan, but somebody was waving.
It's transactional.
It's very. It's and which it never was, and that's.
It's not supposed to be, but
that's
yeah.
So yep. Sad.
By the way, when you say 20 years ago, that was only 2003, I think, a lot, or 2004.
Right, maybe more like 30 years ago.
What kind of writing on the wall did you see back then? What do you remember about the landscape of college sports?
I remember back in the 90s doing the NCAA tournament, the basketball tournament. And I remember there were some players on the Cincinnati team, University of Cincinnati. And the school, University of Cincinnati, was selling trading cards with their image on it. And they said, hello? And we're not getting a dime from this? And they rightfully came forward, they got representation, and they sued the university, and they won. And, of course, what ended up happening is that they didn't get any money from it, but they stopped selling the cards. That's my memory. That could be slightly different from what actually happened, but that was what I remembered. And I remember, who was the coach back then?
Was that Bob Huggins?
Bob Huggins. Yep. Bob Huggins was the coach, and he was firmly, firmly supportive of his kids and of his team, and said, you know, and they were in the right. And so when you saw something like that happen, you knew that was just going to be the beginning of whatever.
Well, to that point, I think every coach in the country believes NIL should happen, but it
sure.
Should be what it is, right? Caitlin Clark, when she was at Iowa, her name was probably bigger than Iowa. An offensive lineman in Alabama, he's only being known for what he can do because he's at Alabama.
Yeah.
And so NIL means you really can sell yourself.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the NIL money that's being given is not the way it's intended to be used.
No. No.
And that's where the problem probably is going to get worse and worse and worse.
Listen, when you can have billionaires, put out on social media that they will pay for X millions of dollars for a quarterback. I mean, it just doesn't seem right. Of course, I'm old school too, and I don't love what's happened to the Big Ten personally.
Right.
You know, I
yeah, it's hard to see UCLA playing Penn State in a conference game. Yeah.
Alongside myself and George Wares, that was NBC sports reporter Andrea Joyce. For today's Lely Radio Sports page on KNIA KRLS, I'm Trevor Castle.